Now, the Reverend Doctors William Gill and William Dalrymple were ministers of the parish church in Ayr, which was Robert Burns' hometown. Dalrymple baptized Burns when he was 1 day old. McGill, the Dr. Mack of the poem that I'm going to read, was the associate or second minister of the Ayr Church. He gained notoriety when he published a book on the death of Jesus Christ. Brought up on heresy charges, at first he recanted. He then returned to Ayr and kept on preaching the way he had always been preaching. As Burns wrote in his poem, Holy Willie's Prayer, which I'll discuss more later in the sermon, Orthodox, Orthodox, why believe in John Knox? Let me sound an alarm to your conscience. There's a heretic blast has been blown in the West that what is not sense must be nonsense. Dr. Mack, you should stretch on a rack to strike evil doers with terror. To join faith and sense upon any pretense is heretic, damnable error. Dalrymple mild, fill your hearts like a child and your life like the new driven snow. Yet that will not save you. Old Satan must have you for preaching that threes ain't and twat, one and two. And Burns goes on to write, Calvin's sons, seize your spiritual guns. Ammunition you never can need. Your hearts are the stuff, will be powder enough, and your skulls are storehouses of lead. Now, I've obviously translated some of that from the old Scots, but Dalrymple and McGill were known as New Light ministers, or liberal in their theologies in the Church of Scotland. They were reformers in what was arguably the most conservative of the European Protestant churches. I've heard one Scots folk singer describe it as a religion so cold it could freeze up the blood in their hearts. As New Light ministers, McGill and Dalrymple represented the Enlightenment with its emphasis on rationalism. Their opponents, the Old Light ministers, were the conservatives who held to a strictly orthodox or literal interpretation of the Bible and also a very strong emphasis on moral rectitude. This will also be dealt with later in the sermon. When the New Light ministers approached passages that were clearly allegory, they treated them as such, rather than trying to explain Jonah's 3 days in the belly of the whale, or the parting of the Red Sea for the Israelites to pass through, only to close in on the Egyptian soldiers. Dalrymple and McGill went even further than most. One might even see them as small-u Unitarians, with tendencies toward universalism as well. Now, we see a hint of this in the verse on Dalrymple. Although his heart is as mild as a child's and his life as innocent as the new-driven snow, old Satan will have him for preaching that 2 and 1 equals 3. The controversy in this passage is, obviously, the Christian Trinity. Dalrymple and Burns saw bad theology leading to poor math. Now, Burns' position was clear. He defended both men ardently. We see this in the beginning of the poem when he chides the Orthodox and warns them that a new voice is blasting out the truth that what does not make sense must be nonsense. He fires another volley again near the end when he tells the Calvinists that they have no need for ammunition because your hearts are the stuff, will be power enough, and your skulls are storehouses of lead. One can almost feel the repercussions more than 200 years after those words were first published. Burns was taking on the Church of Scotland, armed with his rapier wit. I would argue that Byrne saw the inhumanity in the church's teachings, the absurdity of trying to live a life that stifled our emotions and made us little more than incarnate or inanimate playthings for a petulant God. Burns has taken on the very idea of predestination, the idea that most of us are born into this world to suffer and to live rotten lives, while just a few people, born as the elect, God's chosen few, will have material wealth, which was a central part of Calvinism, and they will be seen as moral leaders, the type of people who we should try to live our lives after, sometimes. It is the elect who are the targets of Burns' wit in yet another poem, and an address to the unkogi, or the rigidly righteous. Unkogi translates to uncommonly good. And we all know what happens to people who intend to see themselves as uncommonly good. They often get caught on their own hypocrisy. We've seen this with the television evangelists who were so frequently preaching against gay marriage, against any type of sexuality beyond reproductive, and then getting caught in numerous scandals. Burns writes, "O ye who are so good yourself, so pious and so holy, you've naught to do but mark and tell your neighbor's faults and folly." Burns then goes on to challenge them, look at their own lives and to acknowledge their own imperfections before they act self-righteous and chastise their neighbors. This theme of inflated self-importance is replete throughout Burns' poetry. I believe that it is that part of his life, much of which was spent struggling to eke out a living as a farmer, that led him to an early death at the age of 37. And it's playing out in his disdain for those people who feel that they're the elect, they're special, and he's just a dirt farmer. We see this theme playing out, again in the Holy Rosary's prayer. William Fisher was an elder of the Kirk, or a church elder. Holy Willie, as Burns referred to him, was probably the paradigmatic example of what I would call the rigidly, wretchedly self-righteous. As a church elder, Holy Willie believed that it was his duty to make sure that all the members of the parish behaved themselves, not just in public, but in the privacy of their homes, as they would say. It seems as though Holy Willie was doing his duty and making sure that the flock was behaving when he was caught peeking into people's windows. This led to him acquiring a reputation for voyeurism. When caught, he responded that he was only doing his duty to make sure that none of the members of his parish were misbehaving, even in the privacy of their homes. In a story reminiscent of this, the evangelist of our time, Holy Willie again became caught up when it was found that he was involved in a romantic relationship with a young girl. In an imaginative moment, Burns pictures himself sitting in the church when Holy Willie believes that Holy Willie is alone in the church, talking to God without anyone else hearing. But Burns is there somehow in the back, and he hears Holy Willie's discussion with God. Now, Burns attacks the smugness of those claiming to be the elect from the beginning of Holy Willie's prayer, as he writes, "O thou why in the heavens dost dwell, why, as it pleases best thyself, sends aim to heaven and tend to hell, all for thy glory, after knowing good or ill they've done it for thee." So, in essence, it doesn't matter how you live your life. If you're one of the elect from the beginning, you've got the express route to heaven, and the other 10 people are going to hell. Sounds like poor theology. Now, although it's a bit of a stretch to listen to the Scots dialect and words, the message is clear. If there is a God worth worshiping, it will not be a vain creator who places us on the earth merely to suffer, while as an act of folly, one person out of 11 will be saved or be favored. It will also not be a God who condemns the vast number of us to eternal suffering. Rather, it will be a God who is not afraid of reason or enlightenment, a God who honors both wisdom and knowledge. It will be a God of love and compassion, one who sees a purpose in creation and, in good universalist fashion, favors hope, not hell. Now, it seems that Holy Willie had an unfortunate fate. He died by the side of the road on a winter night, allegedly with too much of what we might refer to as antifreeze in his system. Although Burns predeceased Holy Willie by nearly a decade, his disdain for Holy Willie was so strong that among the things among his various writings was an epitaph on Holy Willie. Obviously published long before Holy Willie's actual death, Burns describes Holy Willie as being placed in his grave and then immediately taking a left-hand turn to join his soulmate, the devil. Now, what stands out through all of Burns' poetry is his empathy for the common person. Although he was lauded as Scotland's national poet by the time that he was in his mid-30s, he never lost contact with the farmers and the workers whose labors drove the industrial machine. He loved to hang out in Edinburgh and party there. And that was where Adam Smith, who's known as the founder or the father of capitalism, was one of his contemporaries teaching at the University of Edinburgh. Burns remains the most renowned of the Scottish poets and is fondly referred to as the Bard in toasts on Burns Nights around the world every year on January 25th. Still, Burns knew the frustration of working the craggy Scottish soil from the time that he was a child. His father, William Burns, was essentially a tenant farmer who moved the family to where he thought he had a better chance of feeding his family. Although he was not a wealthy man, he hired a tutor to work with his children. He wanted them to learn to read and to do math. I remember reading that the elder Burns told the tutor that the children were not to engage in just rote memorization. Before they had to memorize anything, they first had to know how to explain it. So they weren't just memorizing to memorize. They were memorizing something worth memorizing. Robert Burns, as a child, became a voracious reader. He devoured the classics as well as Scottish poetry. By the time that he was 17, he started writing poems in his commonplace book, as he called it. Now, many of the early poems, and the later poems as well, because he never changed throughout his life, were romantic poems. He loved to entice the women. Jean Armour bore him several children in their years together, in their on and off again engagement. Her parents saw him as a starving poet and would not allow her to marry him. They thought he was unworthy of her. And during that time, he made plans to emigrate to Jamaica with yet another woman, Highland Mary. Highland Mary Campbell, unfortunately, died before the voyage, and Burns decided rather than going to Jamaica, he would stay in Scotland. Eventually, when his first book of poems began to sell, Jean Armour's family began to change their mind, and they allowed him to marry. Burns' philandering continued, and he accumulated a brood of both legitimate and illegitimate children through the years. Once, the mother of one of his illegitimate children died in childbirth. It was the day after Jean Armour had given birth to one of their children. So Burns and Jean took the child of the woman who had died into their home and raised it as one of their own. Now, Burns had the ability to write poems virtually anywhere and for every occasion. And this was something that profoundly affected him. And so he wrote The Poet's Welcome to His Ill-Begotten Daughter. I love this poem because he displays his humility and his humanity in a very self-deprecating passage. He writes, "Good grant that thou may inherit thy mother's curse and grace and merit, and thy poor worthless daddy's spirit without his failings. 'Twill please me more to see and hear of it than its stocket mailings." Stocket mailings means a cupboard full of food. Remember, Burns was a starving poet, so to imagine a cupboard full of food was heaven. It is this touch of humanity that has endeared Burns to Scott's readers. He not only acknowledged his own faults and failings, he was also willing to laugh at himself. One of the rousing songs that he wrote later in life was The Deals of Wildwood Excisemen. Carolyn and Diane played that for this morning's offering. In this rollicking song, Burns describes the devil fiddling into town, because the fiddle was known as the instrument of the devil, not the bagpipes. And as he fiddled into town, he then fiddled out of town with the excisemen, or the tax collector. The irony of this is that when the Scottish government realized that its greatest poet was working himself into an early grave on their land, he was given a sinecure as the excise agent or tax collector. As I said, Burns was willing to laugh at everything and everyone, including himself. Now, I believe that Burns lives on and is celebrated in Burns Night dinners around the world every year, every January, because he captured the essence of a good and spirited life in his poetry. He loved his country and its people. He celebrated their honesty and virtues, and he lampooned their foolishness and hypocrisy. Now, for their part, the Scots people love Burns. It's no coincidence that two of the songs, both of them, are known as the Scottish National Anthem, were both written by Burns, at least the words for both of them. Auld Lang Syne and Scots Wha Hae with Wallace Fled, which is based upon a tribute to William Wallace, who was the subject of Braveheart. And allegedly much bigger in heart, in mind, and stature than Mel Gibson. Now, I enjoy preaching from Burns' poetry because he calls us to theological honesty. He tells us to get rid of our pretentiousness to see the difference between sense and nonsense. The God that he describes is a gentle being, abundant in loving kindness. It is a God who loves the common folk and is loved in return by those who have not been showered with worldly wealth, but still choose to live honest lives, compassionate lives. As I said, Burns had an amazing ability to come up with pithy lines or sayings wherever he went. One of the most famous and popularly used is this one, known as the Selkirk Grace. You may have heard it at a meal, particularly if you've ever been to a Burns dinner. And although we weren't able to pull it off last night, it will be on the calendar for next January. In this grace, which many of you have heard, Burns writes, "Some have meat and cannot eat, and some would eat that want it. But we have meat and we can eat, and so the Lord be thanked." Well, as a minister, I like to think of the congregation and a kind of a grace to the congregation, the caring community that you have worked to create over the years. And so I'm tempted to paraphrase Burns. Some would participate if they could congregate. Others congregate but will not participate. But we congregate and we participate, and so the Lord be thanked. Well, thank you for coming out this morning to participate. Let us continue working together to build a congregation that will be strong, compassionate, and worthy of the religion that we all love.